Kia ora. Welcome to Lunch Money, the audio version of the live webinar that takes questions from our investors.
Welcome to another special week of Lunch Money, US Shares Edition. My name's Leighton. I'm one of the co-founders of Sharesies, and this is Sonia, another one of the co-founders of Sharesies. For the last couple of weeks, we've been chatting all about US shares here on Lunch Money. We started with an intro to US shares with financial consultant Tyrone Ross, which was an absolute highlight. It was followed by an Ask Me Anything session with our product manager, John, who is also, of course, always a highlight. And if you've missed any of those episodes, you can check them out on our YouTube channel or via our Lunch Money podcast, which is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts. Today, third highlight in a row, we're joined by business journalist Rod Oram for a deep dive into the US economy. Rod is a regular contributor to Newsroom, 9 to Noon, and Newstalk ZB, so you've probably heard lots of them, covering deep sustainability, business, economics, and innovation. Just a reminder that if you have any questions for Rod, you can submit them through the Ask a Question button down below. We don't really chat, follow the chat off to the side, and always a legal disclaimer, which is there's no personalized advice, so it's our opinions only, and we won't tend to answer questions that get too personal. And finally, just please be kind and respectful towards our speakers and your fellow viewers. Otherwise, we will have to take steps to remove you from the webinar, which we definitely don't want to do. We're going to skip the news or share market update again today to jump straight into the Q&A with Rod. But if you're keen to stay in the loop with what's happening in the markets at the moment, then just make sure you subscribe to our Lunch Money Market email. There's a link off to the side now, and it goes out every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and it covers both the New Zealand and US share market. Sonia, I'll hand over to you to introduce Rod.
Excellent. So, as Leighton mentioned, we're joined today by Rod Oram, a business journalist, and I think with so much going on at the moment, hugely excited to talk to Rod and get his views on what's going on. So please do chuck any questions you've got in the chat. I think Rod is, yes, welcome Rod.
Hiya.
Excellent. So thanks heaps for joining us today.
Oh, my great pleasure. Kia ora to you both, Sonia and Leighton. Great pleasure to be on the webinar with you.
Thank you. So to kick off, can you tell us a bit about yourself? Who are you and what's your story?
Oh, right you are. I'll keep this very brief. I like to say that I'm 23 years old as a New Zealander, so I'm still, you know, young and exploring things, but I was 46 when I arrived here. But being here in New Zealand these last 23 years, both for myself and my family, has quite changed us. You know, this place has had its way with us. So although I might still sound a bit English, I feel very New Zealand. I've been a business journalist for a long time, since 1975. And in fact, when I was studying economics at university in the US, that was when Richard Nixon, as president, took the US off the gold standard. So what I've been through from end of the gold standard in 1970, that would have been actually 72, through to where we are today, has been an extraordinary experience. And I just love being a business journalist because it's my way to try and make sense of the world. I just figured out at an early age, if you just try and follow the money, that it starts to explain a little bit about how societies and work. And so that's essentially my role as a business journalist.
All right, I love that. So as you know, we've just added US shares to Sharesies. And part of what we're talking about here is an introduction into the US share market and the economy. So at a high level, can you tell us what's happening in the share market at the moment in the US?
Yes. Overwhelmingly, there is just, on one hand, this vast amount of money seeking places to invest. It's because of more than a decade now of quantitative easing from central banks, initially because of the global financial crisis and then lackluster growth afterwards. And now that quantitative easing has massively increased. So the Fed's balance sheet has ballooned spectacularly this year by far more than it did after the GFC. So we've got all this money sloshing around, and it's very hard to know where to put it. So if you're in bonds, well, yields are virtually well, are negligible and could well be heading negative in many places. And therefore, there's not any upside for capital or income there. And so people have been turning ever more to stock markets. So I think that's one of the very big factors. So this has been the deepest, quickest bear market pretty much ever in stock markets, with when the pandemic finally hit in the US and globally from late February onwards. We saw this extraordinary drop in markets, but we've seen this even more remarkable recovery since. And as I say, probably the deepest, shortest, quickest bear market ever. I find it very difficult to try and have a deeply thoughtful, measured view as to what this all means, because we are, in a very literal sense, in uncharted territory. And there are parallels, and I happily come back to this later, in the period from the early 80s to the 1987 stock market crash. Because in 1982, there was a sudden huge turnaround, both in a lot of confidence that rampant inflation had been finally knocked on the head. And so there's this huge shift out of bonds into equities. And that triggered an extraordinary run-up in markets globally and, of course, in the US. Then we had the 87 stock market crash. In some ways, there are parallels to this. But this is still has all sorts of complexities and factors that we were never dealing with then. And it's very hard to know where it's all going from here.
And so interesting that you've got such that great background, or having seen these different events. What are you seeing at the moment in the US economy?
First of all, a great deal of uncertainty. And there's essentially three reasons for that. The first one is the pandemic itself. So the US has been dealing extremely badly with it because of a complete lack of political leadership, but also a very substantial segment of the population are deeply dismissive or refuse to believe the science and the rest. So the social response has been pretty irresponsible in the States. So it's one of the highest case and death rates from the pandemic around the world. What that then means is there's a great deal of uncertainty, fear, and insecurity in the economy as a large, as a whole. In fact, so many jobs have been lost that total employment in the United States is now back to where it was, I think, in about 2015, certainly well below where Trump became president. And the US economy, even with the uptick in employment in August, here's a really important thing. That's monthly data, but it's based on a forecast or a survey done in the second week of a month. So the recent employment data was actually polling the market, the employment market, in the second week of August, and things have got worse since. And so there are still, the US economy is still 11 million jobs short of where it was before the pandemic hit. And then Congress has completely failed in its job after a pretty good start on it, on the CARES package, the original first pandemic support package. It was a good comprehensive one to follow through. So more money for the unemployed and other subsidies and support has not been renewed. And it looks as though the debt lock in Congress means that's not going to happen this side of the election. And that won't get better unless there is a change of control of the Senate and of the White House, to be blunt. And so this is an economy in the US which is actually really struggling. And of course, you get great variation. We're seeing it obviously in the stock market, and there's some obvious reasons why big tech stocks are doing well and other sectors aren't. So the hospitality and tourism sectors are, and entertainment sectors are, of course, still very hard hit, as are the airlines. But other sectors of the economy are doing reasonably well. So an incredibly mixed picture. And then I'll say there's one last big factor, which is I think the US is in really quite a parlous state as to whether it can maintain its technological and economic leadership in the world. Under Trump, it's pulling back from a lot of international leadership anyway, and where it is trying to exercise it, it's some of it's quite off the wall. China has not only grown its economy hugely, but extraordinarily increased its science and technological capability, its innovation capability. So one of the longer term questions I have about the US economy is if it's actually going to regain not just a good level of economic activity, but regain a real confidence in its innovation system, in its science and research systems, because that's what it's going to need if it's going to reestablish itself. I think there's some doubt now that it's still got that number one slot in terms of the most advanced capable economy in the world.
And you touched on it a little bit, but we've been hearing about the disconnect between the US share market and the economy. Can you explain what this is all about and why that's happening?
Yes. Now, I'm just going to look back at some data I was just looking up. And one way of looking at share markets is what the value of a share market is as a percentage of GDP. Now, a really big caution here. When you're looking at the value of shares, that's a stock of value because that's how much all those companies are worth in the share market. However, GDP is actually measuring a flow of economic activity. So you've got to be very careful to understand that one's a stock and one's a flow, and they aren't directly comparable. However, you can use this measure to get some insight into how dominant a share market is in the US economy. And what I was looking up was back in 1990, US stock markets were only worth 60% equivalent to GDP. In 1990, it had got to 120%, and now it's 200%. So that's an extraordinary growth in the value of those shares. And it's quite clear that the value of those shares no longer has any relationship to the value of the economy, if you like. And then just to set that in an international context, if you go back to the extraordinary asset bubble in Japan in the 1980s, their market peaked in 1989 at 140% of GDP. And even that at the time was considered unhealthy and off the charts. Another way of looking at it is what's actually going on in those companies on the stock market. And this is a lovely bit of data from the Brookings Institute in the United States, that if you go back to 1962, when there were really big companies on the stock exchange, like AT&T, the telephone company, or General Motors, the two of them employed 1.2 million people. But if you look at, and they were the two largest companies on the stock market back then. But if you look at the two largest companies on the stock market today in the US, they only employ 280,000 people. So there's very substantial disconnect between the value of those companies and the level of their economic activity versus the economy as a whole. Having said that, you can still drill down in a stock market, particularly as one as wonderfully large and diverse as the US, to pick sectors that are far more hands-on in the real economy and therefore are a better proxy for economic activity. And therefore, that's a very interesting place. It's always an interesting place to look for stocks to invest in, but it's a particularly interesting place these days because of these huge disparities between sectors, depending on how they're coping with the pandemic.
Well, so interesting, Rod. Tied into all this at the moment, there's a lot of talk around volatility, so the ups and downs of markets. And I think even something as large as the S&P 500 index at the moment, trading up and down over 2%, you know, every morning I wake up and check, it seems to be these big numbers of volatility. But one of the interesting roles you had was as a Wall Street correspondent, I believe, covering the crash in 1987. So I'd be really interested to hear from you a little bit about that and also how it compares to what's happening at the moment.
Yes. Well, the risk of sounding like, you know, an old bloke who's been around too long. I was a young journalist at the time, I hasten to add, or younger. And I'd already been at the Financial Times in London for some years. But I got my first overseas posting, and it was to New York, to be the paper's Wall Street correspondent. And I was appointed to the job in May of 1986. And my wife and I were visiting New York to see where we might live and all that kind of stuff. And I desperately hoped that this extraordinary stock market tear and boom would continue at least until I'd arrived. Well, as I was scheduled, we did arrive in September of 86, and it kept going until October 87, famously Monday the 19th, 1987. And it was a very memorable time for me because I did have a year in the job to really get to know Wall Street and lots of people on Wall Street and lots of people to talk to. But as it happened, on the Friday before the stock market crash, I was out in Omaha, Nebraska, interviewing Warren Buffett. He was a very impressive investor at the time, but nowhere near the household name he subsequently became. And it was quite an extraordinary experience because as he met me in the lobby of his very modest offices and we walked down the corridor to his office, the walls were lined with newspaper front pages of stock market crashes through the generations. And he didn't want to talk about where the market was at because he was always a long-term value investor and he thought it was all crazy what was going on. So I had a extremely wonderful morning with him. And I did some more stuff in Omaha and flew home that back to New York that evening. And because it's pre-text messages and internet and all the rest, so I wasn't really plugging into what had happened on Wall Street on the Friday afternoon. And I knew it was a triple witching hour where a combination of deadlines coincided for various options and futures. And triple witching days were really rocky days because they tend to used to then cause a huge amount of volatility in the market. And I knew one was coming, but I didn't take any notice. On the Saturday morning, I picked up the New York Times off my front doormat of my apartment and saw it had been a spectacularly awful day. And I spent the weekend talking to people in the market, trying to work out how the market was going to perform on Monday, because I was on duty that weekend and I had to write a news story for the Financial Times. And the market makers, the people on the New York Stock Exchange who use their own capital to literally balance out buy and sell orders in those days to make those markets, were utterly shell-shocked because they had completely exhausted their capital on Friday and they weren't able to establish a price at which stocks would trade. And so the stocks were literally in freefall. And just to set that in perspective, when we got around to the Monday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 22% in a day, which is way more than has happened any day since. And sitting in the New York Times office in our New York office for the FT that day with my colleagues, we were watching the old Telerate screens, early digital technology there, and all the market measures that, I tracked, hour by hour, were just completely off the charts. One last story about all this. When the market closed, I took the subway downtown to the stock exchange. And I've never been in a press conference where journalists were palpably scared. There was an extraordinary sense of fear in the room. As I thought a relatively experienced financial journalist was going, well, this is pretty amazing. So one very panicky journalist said to John Phelan, the chairman of the stock exchange, oh, you know, the stocks, they've fallen, you know, 22% today. If it goes on like this all week, they'll go to zero. What's your advice? And John Phelan, who is this wonderful Irish-American New Yorker, with a completely straight face, but with a twinkle in his eye, said, well, my advice would be to buy at one. And the next week was extraordinary because we had this huge dance between the futures and options markets in Chicago, the stock markets in New York, and the Fed in Washington. And what was making matters worse was huge miscommunications between those three crucial players in all this. By the Wednesday, the markets, the whole financial system, had come perilously close to collapsing entirely. And the reason it didn't was there was a misunderstanding between the futures market and the cash market. They both thought that the other was going to cease trading. And so that just took the heat out of the issue, and they stopped chasing each other down. And that finally took the pressure off to allow the exchanges and the Fed to restore some sort of sanity by the end of the week. So far more perilous in many ways than anything we've seen so far. But again, I want to stress that the markets are so big these days, there's so much money sloshing around, that in some ways there's a greater problem storing up here, which makes me apprehensive, I'd have to say, if people in business, people in politics, people in society in general don't, you know, keep calm and try to navigate us through what's going to be a very, very difficult few years ahead. Sorry, that was a long answer.
No,
I was reminiscing too much.
It's a great answer. So many things that I feel like we need to speak more about in there, not least. I mean, did you end up having McDonald's for breakfast with Warren Buffett? Or
No. He offered me a Diet Coke. That was it.
Right, no, that's still very cliched, Warren, from what you read about him online and
yeah,
everything.
But I must just say one thing about Warren Buffett, because he yesterday he did the most extraordinary $500 million financing of Snowflake, a very, very interesting upcoming IPO in cloud computing, data storage. And I'm fascinated he's done that, because he's always been so strict, and it's one of his key disciplines, has been only to invest in companies that he understands. So he, you know, shunned Microsoft, even though Bill Gates was a good friend of his for a long, long time. So I'm really thrilled, seeing as he's about 27 or 8 years older than I am. No, sorry, about 17 or 18 years older than I am, that it's still possible to learn new tricks when you're an old dog.
I have to read about that afterwards.
Oh, do.
There's an election coming up in the US. It's hard to avoid that particular fact at the moment, 3rd of November. What kind of impact do you think that this might have on share markets in the US economy?
I take a deep breath on that one. It's very, very hard to predict. The simplest way of looking at this is that if Trump wins, it will probably be quite close, and there will be a lot of concern that the election hasn't been fair and credible. What it would be even more concerning, and there's an awful lot of war game stuff going on in the States to understand this, is if Biden won not just the popular vote, but also won a very slender majority in the Electoral College, that Trump would go on air that night and declare that he was the winner, if he was slightly ahead, he was the winner. And then the most extraordinary amount of politics, litigation and everything else ensues from that. It would be astonishingly destabilizing. And that's a very real risk that people are taking seriously. So, but if Trump is president, what you'd have is a great deal more policy chaos, policy contradiction, and everything else. If Biden won, there would be a lot more stability. And that would be a good thing for the US economy. So at this point, I probably just leave my prognostication at that level, because trying to build on the beyond those two broad themes is actually pretty difficult. I suppose I should add one caveat, a hopeful one, is that the US economy is large, multifaceted, as is US society. And there is some bedrock sensible stuff goes on in the country. That's where I'd be looking for comfort.
Great, thank you.
And so if you're new to investing in US shares, because knowing that a lot of our investors, this will be their first time getting into it, we've talked a lot about what's going on in the economy at the moment, but what are the key things that new investors should keep their eye on, and what are we likely to see in the short and long term?
What I'm about to say is, in a sense, incredibly generic advice, and it would apply anywhere, and that's... Sorry, I'm going to preface this by saying one thing. I'm terribly excited that such is the technology of for individuals to trade very simply and cost effectively, thanks to Sharesy and other services. That's attracted some people to be direct participants in the market. And my very fond hope is that this is kind of a level of civil society engagement back in the markets. But my really fond hope is that people become shareholder activists, even as very modest shareholders. So that's why I'm delighted, for example, as at Sharesies, you take that governance question seriously. And I know I'm guessing it'll take you a while to build up that capability on the US stocks. But I think it's really important that we shareholders do express our views to companies and get involved when major investors have serious motions before AGMs and vote our shares. So that's why that to me is a big positive about what's going on now. But back to my generic advice. The first one is that be sure only to... put to work a modest amount of money that you can afford to enjoy when you do well, and you can afford to cope with and not get too depressed if you suffer some setbacks. And remember that when you're directly investing yourselves like this in equities, then it's only a part of a far more complicated process of building up and running your financial security over time. And look, even though I'm closely involved in these issues, I mean, not nearly as much as I was decades ago when I was a stock market reporter, but I've always used professional financial advice for those far more complicated questions about where I go over time. The next thing is to play to themes, either around a sector or a technology, rather than and buy broadly into that through particularly the likes of exchange-traded funds, which I think are one of the great innovations in stock markets over the last 10 years. And it's very interesting to see how a huge amount more money is going into ETFs these days. Rather than trying to pick individual stocks, because the danger when you pick individual stocks is that you'll get swept along by all the hot talk about what's going on. It's very hard to be cool and detached when you're picking stocks. It's also very hard to avoid a sort of a bit of a confirmation bias. And here's an obvious one. You know, I've got a lovely Apple computer and lovely Apple iPhone, and you know, it's iCloud services, it's email services, iTunes, you know, App Store. They're all wonderful. Therefore, Apple's a wonderful company. Therefore, I'll buy some shares. But over the last 2 years, the value of Apple on the stock exchange has doubled from $1 trillion to $2 trillion. But Apple isn't worth twice what it was 2 years ago. Oh, and by the way, it listed on the stock market in 1980. So it took from 1980 to 2018 to get to the first trillion. So you can afford to be a bit sentimental about some stocks, but just try and be a little bit dispassionate. The next thing is be patient. Don't be a short-term trader nipping in and out of the market. And then I want to reiterate the first point is, however small you are, be a shareholder activist. It's just like being voting in an election. You know, here in New Zealand, my vote is only one of whatever the number is, 3 million votes or however many people there are over 18 in New Zealand. So in the stock market, I'm an infinitesimally small shareholder, but exercise your democratic rights as a shareholder activist.
I love that.
Oh, sorry, I want to explain that point a little bit more. Good companies are a tremendous force for good in the economy, in society. Now, environmentally, socially, economically, politically, our societies are moving on very, very fast. Therefore, we need companies that can innovate and be very effective in this. So that's why I think being involved as a shareholder and feeling that you are putting some of your personal, albeit a small amount, of your well-being, your personal wealth, to pick some of those companies and try to support them is a great thing to do. But again, in making those choices, you can do that passively. You can just buy the shares. But to take that extra step of feeling that you're exercising your shareholder's democratic rights is a fine thing to do.
And so to make sure we don't get caught up in our own confirmation bias and things like that, where can we go to find out more information about US shares?
It's very difficult because there's an awful lot of I'm going to draw a strict demarcation here. There's an awful lot of information around, and a good deal of that is unfounded, wrong, unreliable, and everything else. So trying to find good advice is hard, it usually requires spending some money, which is difficult. I mean, relative to the investment you're making in the stock market. However, reading the market reports of reliable sources, that might require, depending on your source, and I'm self-promoting here I'm promoting journalism here, not necessarily newsroom itself, is that, there is obviously good journalism around, whether it's some of the investment magazines or other media platforms, it is worth investing a little bit in such sources of information. The next thing is, once you get the hang of trawling around online, you can find various sources of reasonable advice that are free, but it's really important to try and triangulate it. So just don't take one source as, you know, the gospel truth, or, oh, that sounds good, I'll act on that. Make sure you're getting at least three points of view and then trying to see how they fit together would be another really important point to make. And I'd have to say that because I'm not an active investor currently, and anyway, when I was still active, I was not spending a great deal of time I was spending very little time researching particular sectors, because all my time as a business journalist is spent on those bigger economic issues, and particularly how, for example, we speed up our work on our transformation to a net zero carbon economy by 2050. So I've been, in that sense, quite a lot more detached from the market, and therefore I'm reluctant to say, well, there's this source or that source. So that's why I've been a bit more thematic in my answer there.
Great. Thanks, Rod. We are going to go to some questions from some people who've been listening today. And for this ones here, we call them quick fire rounds. So the aim is to answer within like 5 or 10 seconds. So,
oh, right.
We're going to hopefully get through a few. So
I'll put my timer on.
And just for people listening, we're not going to be answering product-specific questions today. We're just going to be focusing on the ones for Rod due to time. But if you have any suggestions or questions, then feel free to more than feel free, we'd encourage you to message into our customer care team, and they should be able to help you out with those. So first one, Rod. See how you go in 10 seconds here. A lot of speculation about there being a tech bubble in 2020, similar to the 2000.com bubble and crash. Is this likely to burst this year? Any idea if it's going to burst before November? Some pretty specific questions there, but maybe just speaking broadly to the bubbles.
I think there's every chance of a serious setback for tech stocks. I know we've seen it this week, but it's very different from the dot-com boom, where a lot of it was on very flaky conceptual companies, whereas a lot of the acceleration of value has been around companies with intrinsically good businesses, you know, the FANGs, you know, the five big ones particularly.
Great, thank you. This question is from Paul. It's, if I buy NZ ETFs tracking, for example, the S&P 500, I pay 0.34% in fees, but if I buy the same index on the newly available US market, then Chesley's charges 0.5% management fee plus a 0.4% foreign exchange fee. What's the point of investing in US shares using your platform with such high fees? Paul, this might be another one, a good one just to send through to our customer care team. A quick summary there is the ETF that you track on the exchange does incur foreign exchange fees and management fees or brokerage fees and all that, and it's included in the unit price of it often, but I'm pretty sure we've got a good response if you email through on what those are, and it'll basically be on how long you're wanting to hold it for and how much you're investing. The next one is another one for you, Rod. What would be American post-COVID economy look like? How long will it bounce back to pre-COVID time, and strength and weaknesses of the American economy?
It's very hard to think about this other than sort of alternative scenarios. The US economy is very adaptable, and therefore, if confidence returned and the pandemic was under control, I could see some pretty vigorous growth. But those are two very big ifs about the pandemic being under control. I mean, whether or not it's going to be a vaccine and how quickly that is in place and how many people get it, how many anti-vaxxers don't get it, those all make that judgment about how the US economy is going to track very difficult to make.
Great, thank you. This one's from Gordon. Rod, would Kiwis invest in the US market or stay local and invest in our own market until both countries' elections are over and everything is settled?
Absolutely both, and don't wait. I think one of the most important pieces of advice that I've learned early and have always lived by is invest long term. So don't wait for something to happen, like an election to be over, because markets pretty much have made that judgment before that event and have built in the outcome they're expecting. And so invest now and stay there long term and ride out these short term, very big problems of elections and the rest. But crucially, do invest in both, because there is access to sectors in the States you can't get here, a very big economy, very different from ours. And therefore, you are diversifying your investments by investing in both. And diversification is always a good thing to spread your risks.
Great, thank you. This one, great question here from Simone. What do you see as the trigger to end the low interest rate cycle?
Inflation. And I just don't know when that's going to happen or if it's going to happen. This is very difficult economically because wise people try and explain why we have all this money sloshing around and it's not causing inflation, and inflation expectations remain very, very low. So that's why interest rates are going negative, because central banks are desperate to get monetary policy to have some kind of effect on the economy. So interest rates are going to remain very, very low until inflation starts to rise. And that's when central banks will have to keep pushing up interest rates to try and kill off that inflation.
Great, thank you. This one here is the US Treasury still printing money? We spoke briefly about this earlier. Is that why the market hasn't crashed yet?
It's the Federal Reserve that is creating money, not the US Treasury. So that's the difference between our Reserve Bank. So it's central banks that create money, not governments. What then happens is governments are then able to access some of that money created to issue more bonds, which is exactly what our government's doing. But yes, the Federal Reserve has says that it's going to do whatever it takes. And I'm just looking at the data here on a chart I have in front of me, which is the size of the Fed's balance sheet as a percentage of GDP. And it's now up to about the balance sheet of the Fed is 35% of US GDP. It's not 35% of GDP. It is equal to, and again, I stress we're talking stocks and flows here. Before the global financial crisis, the Fed's balance sheet was 7% of GDP. So it's increased fivefold at a time when the economy's also grown. So that's how extraordinary it's all got. The European Central Bank's even more extraordinary. Its balance sheet is now approaching about 47% of Eurozone GDP. And before the global financial crisis, it was at about 12%. So lots of quantitative easing going on. That's one way to measure how much is going on.
Great. Thank you so much. Just looking at the time here, we're going to leave the questions there for today. Thanks so much, everyone, for sending them through. And we'll, if there's any that we go through afterwards, we might clear them up at the start next week. But I'll hand over to you, Sonia, to wrap up.
Excellent. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in today and for asking so many great questions. And a huge thank you to Rod for joining us. Seen so many great comments coming through great stories, great insights. Thank you so much.
Lots of invites back in the chat, Rod. So we'll have to...
Oh, I'm happy to come back anytime.
Fantastic. Okay. So that wraps up our special three-part US shares series. Next Thursday, we'll be joined by Lewis Graydon, who's the CEO of the NZX-listed company Fisher & Paykel Healthcare. We'll pop a link in the chat for you to register for next week. Otherwise, thanks everyone for joining in and see you next week. Thanks heaps, Rod.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks, Rod. And thank you, everyone.
Take care.
Bye.
For more info, visit www.sharesies.nz or find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Ka kite anō. Take care and happy investing.